This week, part 10 of Whither Are We Traveling? And Worshipful Brother Darren A. Lehner's contemporary examination of the text. Hasn't the so-called century of the common man contributed to making our fraternity a little too common? Is it so easy for anybody to join Freemasonry? And what happens when common men become part of our uncommon fraternity? Ritual cheapened? The public image of the fraternity sullied? Then we'll take a look at a recent article from the Knight Templar magazine all about the history of Golgotha and how it got its name, the place of the skull. How did this place get its name? And what place does the skull and the chamber of reflection have in our craft today? All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. Off the bat, we want to thank the producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast. Without you, we can't make this show, and I have to thank you all for almost 11 years of great Masonic education through this podcast. If you want to learn more about how you can assist the WCY podcast in its mission to bring Masonic education to all of those interested, please go to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show and check out the different options available. Additionally, we've got a number of books that we've linked through Amazon with an affiliate sale. Again, it doesn't cost you any more. It just helps us make a couple pennies on every sale. And we've also got a number of items on WCYpodcast.com on the shop where we have exclusive producer pins and autographed copies of various books that I've either written or co-authored. Please check those out. All of that money goes back to support this program. So to start this week off, we want to get right back into doing the good work. And this is, of course, we are continuing the series, Whither Are We Traveling? This is part 10 by Midnight Freemason contributor, Worshipful Brother Darren A. Lehner's. As we continue to explore Dwight L. Smith's seminal work, Whither Are We Traveling?, we begin to explore his answers to the 10 questions he posed for self-examination of the state of ancient craft Freemasonry in 1963. The questions he asked are as important and relevant now as they were then. This week, we look at question number 9. Hasn't the so-called century of the common man contributed to making our fraternity a little too common? Now, before we really begin the article, I want to say that I'll save any of my opinions and thoughts for the end. And if you're curious about the other 9 parts that came before this, they are in previous episodes, pretty much in chronological, linear order, just going backwards. So let's go ahead and begin. Most Worshipful Brother Smith begins this section with a legend from the Napoleonic Wars about a young man who was too young to fight, who was permitted to carry the banner of his regiment. During an engagement, his unit was advancing on the enemy under heavy fire. The young man, full of enthusiasm, went so far ahead of his unit that he was almost out of contact. The commanding officer sent a runner to him, bearing a message to have him come back to the line. The lad sent a reply to bring the line up to the standard. He then goes on to discuss a politician of his era that referred to his time as the quote-unquote century of the common man. Although no man considers himself as common, and every man wants his sons to be more than common. He goes on to say that the concern is that when we put too much emphasis on common men and common things, we make something that should be uncommon into something common. He then states that he sees evidence for what might be called a Masonic Gresham's Law, in which we witness the sad spectacle of the standard being dragged back to the line instead of being brought up to standard. He then says that, like it or not, the trend in Freemasonry, in this case, in his home state of Indiana, but one could read this to be universal, is to alter the pattern to fit the cloth. He goes on to confess that he is not merely unburdening himself of a personal irritation, but he is putting into print what has been whispered into his ear for the past 15 years. So, since 1948, since this was published in 1963. He then says, quote, "When we cease to set a lofty mark and expect our brethren to measure up to it, when we permit a downward adjustment to conform to practices and manners that are casual and lax and crude, we are dealing our beloved fraternity a double blow. First, a blow from without. Certainly, we must not expect to retain the prestige of the craft has enjoyed in the past if we can lift our sights no higher than the bowling lanes, the drive-in hamburger stand, or the picnic grounds. Second, a blow from within. Will not men respect and venerate Freemasonry more if they know there are certain rules of gentility, of behavior, of dress, of speech, and decorum, which they are expected to observe?
What am I talking about? All right, then let's spell it out. 1. The appearance and actions of Master Masons in public ceremonies. Not always do they create a favorable impression. Only on rare occasions may Freemasons perform their ritualistic work outside the lodge hall, usually a funeral or the laying of a cornerstone. It requires no great degree of imagination to see what damage can be done the entire fraternity when men do not possess that priceless gift known as a sense of the fitness of things. One time I attended the funeral rites for a beloved brother. At the conclusion of the church service, the brethren filed down the center aisle in view of all in attendance to take their places in the escort. The bearer of the three great lights did not know what to do with his headgear. So, down the aisle went the procession with a faded straw hat on top of the Holy Bible square and compasses. What am I talking about? Aprons that are crumpled and soiled. Whether worn without the lodge room or within, the apron itself is disgraced when it is anything less than spotless, and the fraternity is cheapened, to say nothing of the psychological effect upon the wearer himself. Yes, I am talking about the ridiculous spectacle of the Master Mason who appears anywhere with long apron strings dangling from the rear, all too suggestive of the limp tail of an old white cow I used to know. Must we go out of our way to make ourselves a laughing stock? 2. Then there are the coarse and boorish performances by self-appointed comedians and by the Glue Factory Craft Club in conferring the Master Mason degree. I have seen the sublime degree lose all its sublimity in the matter of seconds when an immature man forfeited their opportunity to convey a never-to-before-gotten lesson and choose instead to show off like little boys. On my private blacklist are the names of lodges in which I simply choose not to be present when the Master Mason degree is conferred. Some of them, I am sorry to say, are in Indiana. 24 years ago, Carl H. Claudy was saying the same thing in a short talk bulletin, which the master of every lodge would do well to obtain and read again. And again. 3. Finally, let's lay it on the line. I am talking about the lack of respect shown by the Masons for their lodges, as reflected in the attire they wear to its meetings. It was past Master's Night, an invited guest. I sat on the sidelines to witness the always pleasant conferring of the sublime degree by those veterans who had borne the heat and burden of the day. At first, all went well. The ritual that only past masters know was executed as only past masters can. Then, King Solomon approached the east. The man who represented that wise and noble ruler wore a slouch felt hat, a half size too large, that caused his ears to droop forward. Coatless, his loud patterned sports shirt was buttoned at the throat without benefit of a necktie. Taking his place in the oriental chair, he laid the heel of a yellow right shoe on his left knee and began chewing his gum thoughtfully. Quote, "Even Solomon in all his glory," I mused to myself, "was not arrayed like one of these." End quote. Yes, I know the subject of a man's personal appearance is a touchy one. Nevertheless, I stoutly maintain that appropriate dress for Masons while attending meetings of their lodge simply is not a debatable issue. A lodge hall is dedicated in the name of Jehovah. It is set apart as a place in which the great architect of the universe is an object of our reverence. Why then should there be any question about proper and respectful attire in the lodge room, any more than the church? Recently, a distinguished officer of the Grand Lodge of California prepared a most effective pamphlet under the title, "If Freemasonry is Good, Let Us Talk About It." This one paragraph deserves frequent repetition, Quote, "The Mason who creates a bad impression in whatever field of activity can bring discredit to the craft. I am in the woman's clothing business, and in our business we are concerned about what our female employees wear off the job as well as on. Our sales girls make an impression at all times, and we want it to be a good impression." End quote. Let us not cloud the issue with pious mouthings about how masonry regards no man for his worldly wealth and honors, that it is the internal and not the external qualifications of a man that render him worthy to be a mason. The question is not one of honors, it is one of respect for the dignity of our ancient craft. Mark it down. If the internal qualifications are there, some of those qualifications will show through on the outer side. A mason need not wear a Hart, Schaffner, and Mark suit to show proper respect for his lodge, but certainly there should be a high point below even laziness, and negligence will not permit him to descend. Sometimes I wonder what a serious-minded young mason must think when he looks about the lodge room and sees his brethren attired as they would for an outdoor steak fry. Does his mind go back to the time when he received his preliminary instructions prior to initiation as an entered apprentice? Perhaps he recalls two significant sentences, quote, "Put on your freshest and most immaculate garments," he was told, quote, "that their spotless cleanliness may be symbolic of the faultless purity of your intentions. With your body clean and your garments spotless, you are more suitably prepared to receive that spotless and faultless philosophy which masonry will offer you," end quote. Yes, perhaps the young mason does remember those sentences. He may be one of the sizable army of newly raised brethren that drift away from their lodges never to return. All these practices and many more serve to cheapen Freemasonry in the eyes of the public and in the eyes of the brethren themselves. Much more could and should be said. For example, my criticism has been confined to the Symbolic Lodge. But the Symbolic Lodge does not stand alone in the cheapening process by any means. Organizations which restrict their membership to Masons and which profit by their relationship to the craft are doing their part rather well in dragging the standard back to the line. Now, let there be no defensive bleating that the Grand Secretary has gone over to the silk stocking crowd and is promoting tea parties. The choice is not bowling league attire versus white tie and tails. I only insist that Masons, of all persons, should have the fine sense of the fitness of things, a wholesome respect for the lodge, and the place it should occupy in the lives of men. The same kind of respect a man should show his church when he goes to worship, or the family of a friend when he attends a wedding, or his host when he is invited to Thanksgiving dinner. Just plain good taste, that's all. Will the brethren complain if lodges insist on dignity, decorum, respect? Will interest lag, attendance fall, membership decline? Well, take a look at interest and attendance and membership now. When good men are summoned to the highest and best within them, they usually respond with the highest and best. We might be pleasantly surprised at the reaction of our brethren if challenged to bring the line up to the standard where it belongs. End quote. Now, back to Darren's commentary. I apologize for the long quotation, but I felt that everything Most Worshipful Brother Smith said here needed to be together for context. The first point Most Worshipful Brother Smith has driven home, time and time again in my examination of his work, is that if we want Freemasonry to be taken seriously by the public, then we must act and dress seriously. However, I wonder what he would have to say about Freemasons on social media. I would expect, as I have driven the point home previously, that he would feel that the same rules apply. Speaking about bringing the line up to the standard, I feel that he would be saddened by seeing brethren attack each other because they disagree on the things that we wouldn't discuss in the lodge because they bring disharmony. Reading between the lines, his second point, I believe, is to remind brethren that the degrees, especially the Master Mason degree, are about the candidate. I have seen time and time again the same men that decry the lack of other brethren wanting to participate in degrees badmouth the young men that attempt to participate for doing the same things that they do. Is it not the most hypocritical thing that a brother can do is to exert his ego during a degree that is all about killing the ego? Don't come at me about what happens in the Prince Hall third degrees. What is acceptable behavior in their degrees has no bearing on what we do in our degrees. I am not attacking that behavior, but rather those that ignore Code 365 of the Most Worshipful Grand Lodge of Ancient Free and Accepted Masons of the State of Illinois, which specifically states, "The second section of the third degree constitutes a most solemn and impressive portion of our ritualistic work. In it, we are taught the ultimate lessons of Masonic philosophy. Nothing must be allowed to impair the deep impression which should be made upon the mind of the candidate. Accordingly, the Grand Lodge forbids any levity, horseplay, roughness, and insists that there be no such actions and no audible laughter or other noise in the lodge room which might distract the attention of the candidate. Failure to comply with this code and any action by any officer or member in violation of or inconsistent with the language of this order shall constitute grounds for disciplinary action." End quote. Lastly, Most Worshipful Brother Smith discusses attire in the lodge. Echoing some of the points he tried to make in point one, he is correct in stating that our attire reflects our personal respect for the craft. If we dress like slobs, then we are not giving Freemasonry the respect it is due. Not only that, but we are also setting a poor example for those that come after us. I feel that Most Worshipful Brother Smith hits the nail on the head when he says, "Let us not cloud the issue with pious mouthings about how Masonry regards no man for his worldly wealth or honors, that it is the internal and not the external qualifications of a man that render him worthy to be a Mason. The question is not one of honors, it is of respect for the dignity of our ancient craft. Mark it down. If the internal qualifications are there, some of those qualifications will show through on the outer side." What Most Worshipful Brother Smith says above reflects back to his chapter 3, which was aptly titled, "Asleep at the West Gate." We find a general lack of respect for the craft because we have lowered our standards. Let's face it, in many lodges, a pulse and a checkbook will get you in the door. Investigations are done poorly or not at all. Many Grand Lodge jurisdictions, including Illinois, do not require a background check for prospective members. Many lodges won't even Google a potential member to find out if they are on the sex offender list, have any pending criminal court cases, or look at their social media footprint to see if they are posting conspiratorial nonsense about the craft itself. We recently, in Illinois, have not only endured a rash of anti-Masonic literature being placed at our lodges, but also have had our Grand Lodge offices and other Masonic buildings vandalized. One would think that now, more than ever, we would be vigilant, but there has been no change in our policies regarding vetting our potential members. Many of our problems, especially ones that Most Worshipful Brother Smith has highlighted in this work, are due to not guarding the West Gate vigilantly during his lifetime, and the trend has sadly continued into the present day. Let me state this as clearly as I can. The problems that Most Worshipful Brother Smith has highlighted that we are facing in Freemasonry will not go away if we continue to admit men just because they might have something to contribute to Freemasonry if given the chance. The fallacy of the argument is in believing that every man comes into Freemasonry with a desire to improve themselves. I find it ironic that certain Freemasons that believe that men are known to have beliefs antithetical to the ones taught in Freemasonry should be given a chance to join Freemasonry because they might just have a change of heart. It seems that they have forgotten this question, which we all have answered in our Entered Apprentice Catechism, which is, "Where were you first prepared to be a Mason?" And its answer, "In my heart." Probability dictates that a very low percentage of people that have indoctrinated beliefs that are counter to our core values are going to have an epiphany and change their belief system once they join the fraternity. If you believe the above rationale, do you believe we should start allowing atheists into the craft because they might benefit from Freemasonry? If not, stop pretending that we should allow racists into the fraternity because they might benefit from it. The probability that an atheist might find God due to Freemasonry is the same probability that a white supremacist would be able to peacefully sit in a meeting on the level with men that have different skin color or practice the Islamic, Jewish, or any other non-Christian faith and admit the error of his ways. That probability, while it may not be an absolute zero, is pretty close to it. Not all men are redeemable, and every year when I sit through the jurisprudence report of the Grand Lodge sessions, I am reminded of the type of quote-unquote men we have allowed in thinking they would quote-unquote have a change of heart, but instead have them tarnish our reputation. Most worshipful Brother Smith believed that Freemasonry should not be as common as the prize at the bottom of a cereal box. We do a great disservice to the craft by not caring about the type of men we admit into the craft. If we continue to allow everyone who petitions to join Freemasonry, we have lost our perspective, and I fear we continue to have lowered our standards. Freemasonry is something that we should reserve for the small percentage of men that want to live their life according to its tenets. Not every man deserves to be a Freemason. I have been more than forthright in saying in my previous articles on this very blog that I probably shouldn't have been allowed to be one had the investigation committee done its job properly. Thankfully, I was given the chance to join and attempt to live a life in which I follow the lessons of Freemasonry. However, for every one member that has attempted to live a life inspired by the lessons of Freemasonry, there are hundreds, if not thousands, that have joined and do not. The men that have the internal qualifications will be those that display this convincingly to you and to the brethren of your lodge. They will be the men that do not talk about what they can do for Freemasonry, but rather what Freemasonry can do for them. They will show a desire for self-improvement, not only in the word, but in action. A desire for joining and participating by showing up for those pre-lodge dinners or other events for months prior to petitioning, and continuing this while awaiting their degrees. My point is that when you stand at the ballot box, you need to be sure that the ballot is being cast correctly. And if you have any hesitancy as to why you should allow a man to join, it's your duty to protect the craft and to deny their membership. In my next article, I will explore the next question Most Worshipful Brother Smith poses, which is question 10. Are there not too many well-meaning brethren who are working overtime to make Freemasonry something other than Freemasonry? Darren A. Laners. Wow. So we have covered 10 articles thus far and 9 questions, that first article being an overview. And if you're looking for any additional context to some of this, please go back and check out the different episodes, and you'll see in the description whether or not we're reading from Whither Are We Traveling or not. Recently, I did have a brother reach out and express some concern that perhaps we are only sharing one side of the viewpoint on some of this. However, I did have to remind them that, you know, we have 540 episodes of this podcast, and there are a number of views that have been read on the show that I both agree with and some I disagree with. So I would invite anybody out there who is not a fan of what particular article we're reading to stick with it, because there are hundreds of articles that we have read on the show that show a multitude of different viewpoints. Now, relating back to this particular piece, this question of common man contributing to making the fraternity a little too common, I will say that I think Most Worshipful Brother Smith is being a bit of a curmudgeon. So what I mean by that is he starts getting nitpicky, apron strings and whatnot. And of course, I think that that looks tacky. And I think a lot of the things that he mentioned do in fact make us look not the greatest in the eye of the public. But back to this idea of letting too many people, common people, contributing to the fraternity by letting them in, you know, making us too common. And it certainly comes back to perhaps a more acute angle under the wide umbrella of guarding the West Gate. I think most of you may agree with me there. Outside of that particular argument, you know, continuing to watch the West Gate because we have a lack of respect for the craft, because we have quote-unquote lowered our standards. And this, I think, particular piece goes into what happens when we leave the West Gate open. If those other articles that we've talked about talk about the importance of guarding the West Gate, this one perhaps gives us a glimpse into why it's important and what happens when we don't. We end up with sloppy degree work. We end up with comedians in the degree work. We end up with people who dress poorly for lodge. We have a slew of things that tend to come back to us in ways that disrespect the sanctity of what Freemasonry is supposed to be. We've got a certified lecturer in the state of Illinois, and recently we were talking over dinner, and he mentioned this idea. He said, and this is true, I think, for all things, but it was especially meaningful the way he put an emphasis on this. He said, we have one shot. And he was referring to the execution of the funeral ritual in the public eye. He said, we have one shot to get it right. It is so important. And I tend to agree with him, in particular, because the reason we have one shot is not that those people are going to go back and see another Masonic funeral. Like, we might go back and see a different degree. All of those things, right? So, very interesting points. I hope you enjoyed this. I would like to ask, for our Craftsman Plus, what, aside from criminal stuff, right, what is perhaps the most disrespectful thing you have seen done in a lodge? You don't have to name the lodge or the person. In fact, I would prefer you didn't. Tell us about something that you just could not believe it happened. Something perhaps even scandalous. I have a number of different things that I can list out for you all, and I certainly will in that post. And maybe we can have a laugh together while we vent some of our frustrations. All right. Now, this next piece comes from the Knight Templar magazine, March 2022, number 3. And it's by Sir Brandon Mullins, Sir Knight Brandon Mullins. And he writes in his article titled, A Place of a Skull. Now, some of you know my fascination with chambers of reflection, of course, our endless debates on their appropriateness in the fraternity, and some of the spiritual and mythological and religious implications and historical facts relating to this practice. So here we go. A Place of a Skull. Golgotha, literally meaning skull, as indicated by Scripture, is the place where Christ was crucified. Why it was called Golgotha remains a subject of debate. The Church Father Origen believed that it was called Golgotha because it was where Adam's skull was buried by Shem. Scholars have argued that the skull referenced by the name Golgotha was that of the numerous animals used for sacrifice and then disposed of there. Some have argued that the word Golgotha was often used in reference to taking a census, commonly referred to as counting skulls. They claim that this was the area outside the gate where people's skulls were counted. There are those who have argued that it was called Golgotha because it came to represent the head of Satan being crushed by Christ. And many argue that it was simply a hill that looked like a skull, and thus was chosen as a particularly macabre place to crucify people. Whatever the reason for its name, its intense significance as the place where Christ was crucified, where he tasted death, remains near universal in Christianity and is the place where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre stands today. In Orthodox Christianity, in particular, the icon of Christ's crucifixion present in every Orthodox church is simply called Golgotha. In the Commandery, our use of the skull is inextricably connected to Golgotha. As Christians, we are participants in the death and resurrection of Christ and are reminded of this in the fifth libation. It is no coincidence, then, that we must literally carry the weight of Golgotha during 1 year of penance, and a portion of our ceremonies allegorically take place at Golgotha in the aforementioned Church of the Holy Sepulchre. However, the skulls we use also have a simpler meaning, that of being a symbol of bodily death, a reminder that any moment we could die, memento mori, meaning remember we die, is never said in our ritual, but much of the order of the temple is built around this important concept in the Christian culture. Our ceremonies make regular reference to the inevitability and potentially immediate nature of death, and being mindful of this fact has been found to be an effective means of motivating virtue by reminding us that our judgment day may come at any time. So it would be best to begin upright living today rather than putting it off until it's too late. Skulls in particular, real human skulls, do a good job of communicating this to us on a visceral level by showing us what our bodies may soon become. There is an involuntary reaction to seeing a real skull that can make a lasting impact on someone in the right frame of mind. And the skulls we see on various regalia and other items are designed to harken back to that original reaction. On Main Street in downtown Ann Arbor, where we constructed our first dedicated asylum in 1868, we adorned it with a symbol of our order, including a very prominent skull and crossbones, along with a Templar cross. We've moved from that building to another, and another, and another, but our symbols remain etched in stone to this day, reminding everyone who looks up of the same lesson we are taught in the Order of the Temple, that the inevitability of death and the gift given to us at Golgotha. I originally drafted this article just days after conferring the Order of the Temple, and was reminded of the setup of our Chamber of Reflection. Ann Arbor Commandery today meets at the Bellevue Masonic Temple, a more than 160-year-old brick building on a lake in a small town. We hold our Chamber of Reflection in its dirt floor, river stone-walled basement, where you can often hear the waves slap against the nearby seawall. When you take your first steps down into that basement, you feel a cool draft, and the temperature drops several degrees. When you finally see, you are greeted by a past commander's relics lit only by a candle, and quickly realize you are underground, cold, and in the dirt. This can't help but invoke images of the grave. This, of course, is by design, and complements the overarching lesson of mortality found in the Order of the Temple, but it remains amazing to see what an impact it has on our incoming Sir Knights. It is perhaps that impact that has motivated Sir Knights on the past to donate their relics to Ann Arbor Commandery, and in so doing, continue to teach the incoming generation that while death will come, our Redeemer lives. Sir Knight Brandon Mullins is past commander of Ann Arbor Commandery 13 in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and he can be contacted at the email address within the article, which you can pick up at the Knight Templar website. I will attach a full PDF of this issue, as long as it's there, to the show notes, and I really appreciate the commentary on this. I think what's interesting about this particular piece, and I've said before, as a member of Templary and my particular philosophy about all of this, so interesting to me that the KT has the kind of patent on the Chamber of Reflection. I think it does a great job within the Masonic system as well. And I think for a Craftsman Plus, I would love to hear about whether A, your lodge has a Chamber of Reflection or something similar, and B, if that was used on you, what feelings did it pull out of you? That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more great educational content, a tarot card draw, and more. I want to thank the producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast. If you are curious on how you can help bring Masonic education to more than 2 million people worldwide who are listening right now, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see how you can help. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.